Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Increasingly, climate change is a very important component in how military planners see the future, and they see what they are doing as militarily managing a planet that is slipping into profound crisis.
That's the voice of Dr. Christian Parenti. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. Parenti about his new book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Wars, and the New Geography of Violence. Christian talks about relationships between militarism, climate change, and neoliberalism coming together for the perfect storm. So stay tuned.
Someone who is asking us to not just look at society through a reflective lens and take some responsibility for what is going on is my next guest, Christian Parenti. His latest book is Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
What is the Tropic of Chaos?
Well, the Tropic of Chaos is basically the global south. I'm referring to the space between the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn, the equatorial regions of the planet. But it's not so much a fixed place as it is, the political space created by the world system, the world order. And what the book is about the way that climate change is already provoking and driving violence. And it is doing that primarily in the global south by interacting with two pre-existing crises, the legacy of Cold War militarism and the legacy of neoliberal economic restructuring. So Cold War militarism has littered the global south with cheap weapons and populations traumatized by war, populations of primarily men trained in war, and when the ideological underpinnings of the conflict of the Cold War evaporated, a lot of the technologies and patterns and habits and relationships and systems that were those proxy wars did not evaporate, and the violence continues now as organized crime or as ethnic violence or as religious violence. It's no longer this great conflict between capitalism and socialism. So that's like the legacy of the Cold War, which is profoundly destabilizing for the South, global South. And then the legacy of neoliberalism is, and neoliberalism being the policy of radical free market economic restructuring promulgated by the Bretton Woods institutions of the World Bank and the IMF since the late 70s, early 80s, has required that states facing debt, which we could talk about why the debt crisis happened, states facing debt have to impose austerity, which is to say, in a nutshell, the state has to reduce its capacity to plan and intervene in the economy. And this is the economic theory of neoliberalism rooted in the work of Hayek and Friedman. And that has systematically led to the dismantling of all manner of progressive and sort of semi-socialist policies throughout the global south. And, I'm talking about within the capitalist world. And so there's a lot of, mixed economic experimentation in the global south from the end of World War II up into the 1980s. And then all of that is just systematically hammered by neoliberalism. So that has led to societies where the state lacks capacity, it can't plan, it lacks legitimacy, it's infused with corruption, and societies marked by tremendous inequality, increases in absolute poverty, and as the, awash in weapons, etc., due to the Cold War. And then now into this comes climate change, expressing itself as extreme weather events like droughts punctuated by flooding. I mean, generally, as the planet warms up, the atmosphere holds more energy and water, there's more evaporation. So there's, in a lot of places, actually an increase in overall precipitation, but it comes in such sudden shocks that the actual experience economically and socially and ecologically on the ground is one of drought. So, like in Kenya, for example, where I open the book, Kenya has actually seen an increase in precipitation over the last 30 years, but it is suffering a major drought because the rain comes all at once at the wrong time as floods that wash away the crops, so it doesn't actually help deal with the problem of creating food and livelihoods for people. So, you know, that combination of the pre-existing crisis of neoliberalism, the legacy of the Cold War, and the onset of anthropogenic climate change, I call that combination the catastrophic convergence, and it plays out differently in different places. And so the book is a tour across the equatorial latitudes of the planet, looking at the specific histories of places and specific conflicts. So the conflict, the sort of interlocking set of conflicts that are the conflict system of the Horn of Africa, the kind of the conflict system of Central Asia, which links the Indian and Pakistani conflicts to the occupation and insurgency in Iraq. And then they look at Latin America and the role of migration from the countryside into the favelas of Rio, and how there's an attenuated but very real climatological link to the drug violence there, and similarly to the drug violence in Mexico, which is met, you know, all of this gathering crisis in the global south is met in the global north by increasingly bellicose plans for open-ended counterinsurgency and counterterrorism on a global scale. And this is expressed in the planning documents of the United States Armed Forces and other European forces as well. And this is not all classified. I mean, you can actually find these reports online where they discuss how climate change will be leading to increased civil war, ethnic conflict, religious warfare, social breakdown, and how the response of the militaries of the developed world are going to have to be a program of constant counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, and, you know, sort of humanitarian interventionism. And so you see that in the global north, the expression of climate violence is increased border militarization and this kind of war on terror, humanitarian intervention, kind of matrix of interventions, the forward deployment of drones and special forces, the embedding of advisory teams, you know, and the outright occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan to some extent fit to this kind of whole posture that is developing. And Libya was an example of this kind of, you know, this system of warfare, which is not particularly new. You know, using proxy, local proxies on the ground, supporting them with air and advisors and, you know, limited special forces and then contractors to help with the kind of logistics, etc. So this is increasingly the posture of militaries in the West, and it is, if you dig into it, though each and every conflict is not described as climate war, if you look into the kind of central big picture planning documents, increasingly climate change is a very important component in how military planners see the future, and they see what they are doing as militarily managing a planet that is slipping into profound crisis.
In relation to the mass militarization that we see today and the linkages that many of our governments are making in terms of keeping ourselves safe, and with the war in Iraq, we saw a precedent being made in that no longer did a country have to be attacked in order to declare war on another. We could simply go in there and you know, attack another country. This war on terror has been not only legitimized by the media, but almost naturalized as the right of imperial states to bring liberating democracy to, you know, backward countries in the global south.
What's happened to the capitalist order since World War II is essentially that the golden era of capitalism, the age of high rates of growth, high rates of profitability, all of which could sustain high rates of taxation and increasing wages while there's still profitable, you know, very high after-tax profits for corporations, that whole golden era from the 50s through the 60s was predicated on the recovery, the rebuilding of Europe and Asia surrounding Japan, and that the model the sort of Keynesian model of industrialization attempted to sort of build internal markets and internal capacities and make capitalism prosperous and include the working classes in a way to fend off the threat of socialism. So that model works because it fits into the Cold War project of the West, and it achieves high rates of growth and profitability while also including elements of the working class. That then begins to break down in the 1970s because the world has finally recovered economically from World War II, and there's a classic crisis of overproduction or overaccumulation. There's just too much stuff and not enough effective demand. Though there are people who still need things like basic sanitation and education and shoes, the classes of people who can afford refrigerators and blue jeans generally by the late 60s already have them, and the world economy begins to slow down, and profit rights go into crisis in the kind of core, mature, older economies like the U.S. and the U.K., and you get a shift in planning elites away from Keynesian demand management towards neoliberal austerity, which is based on cutting taxes on capital, increasing taxes on workers, slashing wages, both direct wages and the social wage in terms of health and educational benefits that people get, smashing union power, and smashing the public sector to pieces. And so that's been the project that begins with Reagan and Thatcher in the West and then emanates out through the World Bank and IMF globally. And it, of course, creates tremendous pushback, sometimes organized and successful and politicized, and sometimes it just creates crisis and violence and desperation. And so the response is from the kind of core economies and core policy establishments of world capitalism is increased repression. You have to manage these contradictions. I mean, the choice, as Machiavelli says, it's like the prince can either treat men well or crush them. And so, you know, if the system of managing a class inequality and a capitalist economy isn't going to be based on sort of ameliorative welfare measures, then the choice for elites is ever greater levels of violence, surveillance, and repression. And so that kind of violence is core to the neoliberal project. I mean, you cannot have the massive deindustrialization of economies, the massive pauperization of previously stable working classes, and the massive upward redistribution of wealth and the disruption and denigration of public services without dislocation, either active, organized political resistance or rising criminality and desperation. And so, in either case, the response is more cops, more surveillance, more repression, wars such as, the war in Libya or various wars that maybe at first glance don't seem to be about that economic order, but are fundamentally about, reestablishing the dominance of the U.S.-led kind of coalition of wealthy nations.
Talk a little bit about the linkage between the already felt climate change impact on local economies, particularly in India, Africa, and this increased ownership and displacement by monopoly companies, who are pushing the farmers away from subsistence farming, for commodified crops.
The clearest example of that, as you alluded to in your question, is in India, where in the book Tropic Chaos, I went to Andhra Pradesh in southern India to look at the link between the Naxalite Maoist guerrilla war movement and climate change. And so what one sees is that there's this drought, and the guerrillas follow the drought. And what they are reacting to is not just the drought, but basically the farmers, in the face of drought, go into debt because they can't turn to the state for assistance, because neoliberalism since 1991 has really stripped the Indian state of its capacities to help farmers. So they turn to the private moneylenders to get some money to try and cope with the loss of crops due to drought and replant in hopes that the next year will be better, or to dig a well to start, irrigating their crops to make up for the diminishment of the winter rains. And so the moneylenders will only lend money for planting cotton. They won't lend money if the farmer is going to plant food crops. And the reason for that is that in an emergency, a farmer could steal his collateral, that is to say, eat the crop. And when a farmer, an indebted farmer, plants cotton, they have no choice but to sell it. Cotton is totally useless to the farmer. And so that ensures the moneylender will get their cash. And so you get, the deeper the drought goes, then the deeper in debt the farmers go. The more in debt they are, the more cotton there is. The more cotton that's planted, the lower the prices on cotton. The lower the prices go, the more the whole cycle continues. And the cotton that's being used is genetically modified cotton, Monsanto's GMO, which at first is, like the first 3 or 4 years, is tremendously productive. Very, you know, you get much higher yields, but it strips the soil of all nutrients. And so it then requires actually increased inputs. So they have to borrow even more money to provide artificial fertilizer for the cotton and pesticides. And so they sink deeper and deeper into debt. And the result is that farmers are killing themselves. 2,000 farmers in Andhra Pradesh have killed themselves. Across India, 200,000 farmers have killed themselves due to their debts. But other farmers, you know, reaching that point of desperation, decide that they're going to kill their oppressors, and they join the Naxalites, and they kill the moneylenders, and they fight the police when the police come to investigate and you know, round up the agitators. And so you have this 40-year-old civil war in India that for most of the last 40 years was pretty contained in West Bengal, and now it's, over the last 15 years, spread down the eastern side of India because of this drought, and that's the kind of dynamic that drives it. And I mean, there's different areas have specific stories. So like in Chhattisgarh, the issue is less drought, it's more about mining. It's not about agricultural immiseration, it's about resisting this massive mining projects. So there's a specific articulation of things in specific regions, but a lot of it is driven by drought and this drought debt cotton violence kind of connection.
You know, many ways a lot of people in Canada would say, well, that's explainable because, you know, those countries don't have a nice democracies like we do in Canada or the U.S. And, you know, they have this despot government, you know, and that seems to be the common explanation. What would you say to them?
Well, there is some truth to that. I mean, democratic government is better than despotic government. I mean, India actually has a democracy, and that democracy has, to some extent, at times, put checks on private interest. And actually, you know, the Congress-led coalition, it has a pretty robust work program, sort of like emergency work program to deal with rural poverty. But the issue is, you know, within democracies is the one that your listeners, I'm sure, are well aware of, and you probably talk about all the time, of like, you know, money in politics and versus people being organized. And so democratic government can be very effective for checking corporate power when people are organized, but it can also be very susceptible to the influence of money. And
I'm particularly ambivalent about that response, because I think that while we do proclaim to have very democratic governments, we do have in Canada legislation that it's now creating same sentences for all, you know, crimes, and that means increasing incarceration.
You have to look at the consent around that, though. You know, that those right wing policies have massive consent. That's part of why you have a right wing government here in Canada, is because there are a lot of Canadians who like that. They like Stephen Harper. And so that then is the question. The question is, why do Canadians like Stephen Harper? You know, it's one thing to condemn these right-wingers. It's another thing to understand, well, why do the working class in the United States and all these places, why do they like these guys?
I would say...
What makes that tick? And then you get into stuff about how people have been conditioned to not think about class questions, and they think about, you know, race and, you know, whatever the various tropes and stories are that these, you know, right-wing populists use to mobilize consent around these repressive projects.
I think it's both. I think that it's also the fact that we have a political system that is not designed to deliver the populist vote. In the U.S., you have two choices, conservative or Democrats. They're both on the same team. In Canada, we have the Liberals and the Conservatives, who are also both ultra-right wing. And, you know, we have the NDP, who plays a leftist-centers policy. So we really don't have a political system that can deliver a populist vote. That's, I think, one of the problems. However, I do think one is better than the other. But I think that that kind of lost sense of agency has led to policies like the SB 1070 bill, you know, in Arizona, being propagated as something that is populist when it's not. The majority of the populations in the U.S., I would argue, would reject that. Yet, those are policies that are being put in place because we don't see our laws, our governments, as part of social construction, as we being parts of that agentic force.
Well, it's also because people are just not organized. You know, I mean, the left is not very organized in the United States. It's more organized in Canada. And when the left finally got organized, they actually pushed back quite effectively against SB 1070 in Arizona and defenestrated the main champion of that. They recalled and got rid of one of the primary right-wing politicians who championed that. But I think there's, you know, this is not an area of expertise of mine, but I mean, now you're getting into the issue of social movements. I mean, that's what the core issue is. I mean, yes, okay, we have a democracies, parliamentary democracies that have lots of flaws. They allow money, all of these advantages, but they do also allow the left to use its you know, all of these civil rights to mobilize and pressure. And to the extent that there has been a humanized form of capitalism developed in the West, it is because of those kinds of class struggles, that labor primarily, you know, the history is primarily of working class people organizing through trade unions and other kinds of movements and political parties to press their demands, and using extra parliamentary tactics like, you know, sit-down strikes and all of this stuff, but then also mobilizing enough pressure so that there is an element of the political class that wants to have stuff like, you know, public health insurance as you have in Canada, that sort of stuff. So one of the issues with right-wing democratic politics has to do with the left not being capable of organizing. In the United States, the left is pathetically, you know, unorganized, and at the heart of it, I think, is the trade union movement, which to my mind is absolutely essential to any revival of the left, and is currently in a very, very bad way and doesn't have much political imagination, and basically just out of desperation shovels most of it, or maybe not most, but a very large amount of money into buying, you know, goodwill with the Democratic Party, and not enough in resources into organizing new sectors of the economy, organizing unemployed people, thinking creatively about having a long-term plan to move the whole agenda back, you know, as far as possible to the left, to kind of have more increased popular control over the economy.
I love your book in that it brings together the efforts of those who are anti-war movements and those that, you know, want to create changes to, you know, improve the environment. What gives you hope that we can accomplish this?
Well, the one thing that gives me hope is the fact that there is plenty of money. It's not like we don't have the resources, and it's not like we don't have the technology, you know. We could get off fossil fuels very quickly. We have, you know, society has invented wind power and invented, you know, increasingly inexpensive solar voltaic technology. So those things exist. It would be horrible if we, like, didn't have those kinds of technologies. We have them. We also have enormous, enormous amounts of money. I mean, the U.S. military budget is so huge. I mean, so much could be done with that money. Corporate America is also sitting on enormous amounts of uninvested cash. And I'm not talking about the profits that are paid or the bonuses. This is just money for operation that is not being invested. With political, all those money and technology could be put in the right direction. So it becomes a political problem, and that's not insurmountable. That's something we can deal with.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. We've come to the end of our show. I want to give you an opportunity to tell our audience how they can access your book.
They can go to their local bookstore. They can go online.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
And now for a brief update on the climate talks that are happening in Durban, South Africa, courtesy of rabble.ca, which is doing a lot of good work covering this conference. So I'll bring that to you now.
You will not believe what happened at COP17 this week. Globally, there have been discussions about whether the World Bank will govern the climate fund. The implications of this mean whether or not developing countries will be further indebted because the World Bank tends to give out loans rather than grants. And it's likely that we're not going to have a global agreement until 2020. And there has been no text yet. It's still in the making. In terms of Canada, it has swept the awards for the worst country at the climate negotiations every day. It has abandoned Kyoto, which is the only legally binding agreement that we have. It has been condemned by countries such as Brazil and China. And Canada has said that developed countries should not have to do more than developing to reduce its emissions, and that developing nations should not use the guilt card. By doing this, Canada is failing to pay for the mess that it has caused and has a responsibility to repay developing nations. Finally, Canada has been lobbying so that developing countries pull out of Kyoto. So, overall this week, Canada has put polluters over people.
As Canadians and citizens of the world, we should feel extremely disappointed in Canada's environmental record. The Liberal government brought us in to the Kyoto Protocol, which was a good thing, but emissions drastically increased under the Liberal watch. And now, as reported by Environmental News Service, Canada's Environmental Minister Kent said that the Kyoto Protocol is the past, but he would not publicly confirm that Ottawa intends to formally withdraw from the accord that binds 36 developed countries and the European Union to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions. Kent told a news conference in Ottawa that he was neither confirming nor denying that Ottawa will pull out of its Kyoto commitments. As we heard in the interview with Christian Parente, this is not an issue of finance nor technology. It's a political problem. And if we don't get organized on the left, and if we don't build strong social movements, our governments, Canada and elsewhere, can continue to stall on climate action with these kinds of announcements. So we know what we have to do. Let's get busy doing it. We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.